makes for a considerable degree of happiness. We rule with moderate strictness, and in return we are satisfied with moderate obedience. And I think I can claim that our people are moderately sober, moderately chaste, and moderately honest.
Yes, I think I understand. I suppose the fellows who met us this morning belong to your valley people.
Yes. I hope you had no fault to find with them during the journey.
Oh, no, none at all. By the way, you were careful to say that the rule of moderation applied to them. Am I to take it that it does not apply also to your priesthood?
I regret, sir, that you have touched upon a matter which I may not discuss. I can only add that our community has various faiths and usages, but we are, most of us, moderately heretical about them. I am deeply grieved that at the moment I cannot say more.
Oh, please, don't apologize. I'm left with the pleasantest of speculations.
All this has been very interesting, but I really think it's time we began to discuss our plans for getting away. We want to return to India as soon as possible. How many porters can we be supplied with?
Unfortunately, Captain Mallinson, I am not the proper person to approach. But in any case, I hardly think the matter could be arranged immediately.
But something has got to be arranged. We've all got our work to return to, and our friends and relatives will be worrying about us. We simply must return. We're obliged to you for receiving us like this, but we really can't slack about here doing nothing. If possible, we should like to set out tomorrow.
I am sorry, but as I have already said, this is scarcely in my province.
Isn't it? Well, perhaps you can do something at any rate. If you could get us a large-scale map of the country, it would help. And it would be a good idea to send messages ahead also to reassure our relatives. How far away is the nearest telegraph line? Well, where do you send? Send when you want anything civilised, I mean. You won't tell me then. I see. It's all part of the mystery. Conway, I must say, I think you're damned slack.
Sit down and be quiet. You're overwrought.
Why don't you get at the truth? I'm all in for the time being, but tomorrow we must get away. It's tomorrow. Essential. We must get...
Captain Mallinson!
Tomorrow he will be much better. The air here is difficult for a stranger at first. But one soon becomes acclimatized.
I expect we're all feeling it somewhat. I think we'd better adjourn this discussion and go to bed. Barnard, will you look after Mallinson? I'll be along shortly.
Surely.
And I'm sure you're in need of sleep too, Miss Sprinkler.
Yes, I am, rather.
I will summon the servants to take you to your rooms.
Now that the others have gone, I don't want to delay you long, so I'd better come to the point.
Please do.
Our return journey has to be arranged, and we can't do it without help. Now, of course, I realise that leaving tomorrow is impossible. And for my own part, I hope to find a minimum stay here quite interesting. But that, perhaps, is not the attitude of my companions. So if it is true, as you say, that you cannot help, please put us in touch with someone who can.
You are wiser than your friends, my dear sir, and therefore you are less impatient. I am glad.
That's not an answer.
I feel sure you have no cause to worry about the matter. No doubt, in due course, we shall be able to give you all the help you need. There are difficulties, but if we approach the problem without undue haste...
I'm not suggesting haste. I'm merely seeking information about porters.
That raises another point. I very much doubt whether you will easily find men willing to undertake such a journey. They have homes in the valley, and they don't care to leave them to make long and arduous trips outside.
Yeah, but they can be prevailed upon to do so. Or else why and where were they escorting you this morning?
This morning? Oh, that was quite a different matter.
In what way? Weren't you setting out on a journey when you chanced to come across us?
I see. I understand. Then it wasn't a chance meeting. I did wonder at the time. So you came deliberately to meet us.
Now that suggests you must have known about arrival beforehand. And the interesting question is, how?
Come onto the balcony. It is rather warm in here. You are very clever, but not entirely correct. For that reason, I should counsel you not to worry your friends by these abstract discussions. Believe me, neither you nor they are in any danger at Shangri-La.
And yet you drug our food?
Ah, you noticed that. Merely a herbal preparation to relieve the respiration.
Ah.
And to help put you at your ease after your ordeal. It appears to have affected Captain Mallinson rather more than the rest of you.
I rather think he drank more wine. But as for wishing us to enjoy our stay here, as I told you, in a personal sense, I shan't mind a great deal. It's a new and interesting experience. And in any case, we do need some rest.
Tomorrow, you may find it even more interesting. And as for rest, if you are fatigued, there are not many better places in the world.
It is very beautiful, I'll give you that. Just look at the mountain. Caracal, you called it. So brittle and clear against the blue immensity beyond. The whole valley might be a landlocked harbour, and Caracal the lighthouse. Look, there, at the light on the summit. It's ice blue. Magnificent. What does the name Caracal mean?
Caracal in the valley patois means blue moon.
I must say I feel full of beans this morning.
Morning.
Hot bath, comfortable bed, and now a fine breakfast. What more could a man want?
It's not at all what I expected. It's so, well, so comfortable.
Good morning.
Morning.
Truly, as your national poet says, sleep knits up the raveled sleeve of care.
I suppose you mean Shakespeare, though I don't recognize the quotation. But I know another one that says, stand not upon the order of your going, but go at once. Without being impolite, that's rather what we should all like to do. And I want to hunt around for those porters this morning, if you've no objection.
I am sorry to have to tell you it would be of little use. I fear we have no men available.
But good God, man, you don't suppose we're going to take that for an answer, do you?
I am sincerely regretful, but I can suggest no other.
You seem to have figured it all out since last night. You weren't nearly so dead sure of things then.
I did not wish to disappoint you when you were so tired from your journey. You may recollect it was remarked yesterday by Captain Mallinson that we are bound to have occasional communication with the outside world. That is quite true.
Yeah, you see, I was right.
From time to time, we require certain things from distant entrepôts, and it is our habit to obtain them in due course. The point of importance is that such a consignment is expected to arrive shortly. Right. And as the men who made the delivery will afterwards return, it seems to me that you might manage to come to some arrangement with them. Indeed, I cannot think of a better plan. And I hope when they arrive...
When do they arrive?
The exact date, of course, is impossible to forecast. The hazards of weather and so on. Oh, it will probably not be longer than 2 months.
2 months? Or three, or four, or five? And you think we're going to wait here for this convoy or caravan or whatever it is to take us God knows where at some completely vague time in the distant future?
I think, sir, the phrase distant future is hardly appropriate. Unless something unforeseen occurs, the period of waiting should not be longer than I have said.
But 2 months? 2 months in this place? It's preposterous.
I'm sorry. I did not wish to offend. If you will excuse me.
Sorry I lost my temper. But you know how I feel. There's something odd about this business. It's crooked. I'd like to be out of it this minute.
I don't blame you for that. Unfortunately, it's not a question of what any of us would like, but of what we've all got to put up with.
That seems to be the way of it.
I'm sorry to admit that we're so helpless in the matter, but I'm afraid it's the truth.
You mean we've got to stay here for 2 months?
Well, I don't see what else we can do.
All right, then. 2 months it is. And now let's all shout hooray about it.
I don't see why it should be so much worse than 2 months in any other isolated part of the world.
After all, people in our jobs are used to being sent to odd places.
Of course, it's bad for those of us who have friends and relatives. Personally, I can't think of anyone who'll worry over me acutely. And my work can easily be done by someone else.
Well, I reckon I'm pretty lucky myself for that matter. 2 months in this penitentiary won't kill me, and as for the folks back home, well, I've always been a bad letter writer.
You forget that our names will be in the papers. We shall all be posted as missing, and people will naturally assume the worst.
Oh, yes, that's true. But it won't affect me, I assure you.
I must say, you don't appear too distressed about it, Miss Brinkley.
As Mr. Barnard says, 2 months here is nothing to make a fuss about. It's all the same wherever one is when one's in the Lord's service. Providence has sent me here. I regard it as a call.
And I'm sure you'll find your mission society pleased with you when you do return.
Yes. I'm sure I should be able to give them much information.
Well, all of us have had a very interesting experience, for that matter. That should be a small consolation.
Heaven knows what we shall find to do with ourselves.
The first rule must be to avoid getting on each other's nerves. Happily, the place seems big enough and by no means overpopulated. Except for the servants, we've only seen one of its inhabitants so far.
Lady and gentlemen, this afternoon, if you are agreeable, I shall be delighted to show you a little more of the Lamasery.
Why not? We may as well give the place the once over while we're here.
When we left Bascule in that aeroplane, I'm sure I never dreamed we should ever get to a place like this.
And we don't know why we have yet.
And the exquisite Pablo song ceramics which you saw in the higher chamber.
Yes.
Now, if you will just turn this way, it is conceivable that you may find these humble paintings of interest.
Exquisite.
This, as you see, is the library of Shangri-La.
Oh, I say. There must be millions of books here.
Sure is.
I think I may say without boastfulness that you will find all the world's very best literature represented here.
English, French, Eastern scripts, Chinese, Russian, why, it's a veritable treasure house for scholars.
And you are a scholar, perhaps?
I enjoy reading, of course, but my work during recent years hasn't supplied many opportunities for the studious life.
Yet you would wish for it.
Oh, I wouldn't say that, but I am certainly aware of its attractions.
Well, here's something for your studious life, Conway. It's a map of the country.
We have a collection of several hundreds. They are all open to your inspection. But you will not find Shangri-La on any of them.
I wonder why.
There is a very good reason. That is all I can say.
Still piling up the mystery, eh?
Aren't you going to show us the llamas at work?
I am sorry to say that is impossible. The llamas are never, or perhaps I should say only rarely, seen by those outside the llamahood.
What do the llamas do?
They devote themselves, madame, to contemplation and to the pursuit of wisdom.
That isn't doing anything.
Then, madame, they do nothing.
I thought as much. Well, Mr. Chang, it's a pleasure being shown all these things, I'm sure. But you won't convince me that a place like this does any real good. I prefer something more practical.
Perhaps you would like to take tea now.
Tea? Yes, that would be very welcome. Thank you. Visiting museums and art galleries always gives me a slight headache.
Then by all means, let's have tea.
Then I shall take you to the Lotus Pool Pavilion.
Pretty little place.
Please be seated, Miss Brinkley.
Thank you.
Good Lord.
What is it, Conway?
I suppose after all the wonders we've seen this afternoon, it's rather naive of me, but I can't help being surprised when I see a modern grand piano and a harpsichord in a lamasery pavilion.
Oh, is that all?
I must tell you that the lamas hold Western music in the highest esteem, particularly that of Mozart. The lamasery has a collection of all the great European compositions, and many of the lamas are skilled musicians.
Do you mean to tell me that this piano was brought here by the route we came along yesterday?
There is no other.
Well, that beats everything. Then I figure you have an agent in Pekin or Shanghai. And I'll bet everything costs a mighty lot of dollars by the time you handle it.
Your surmises are intelligent, Mr. Barnard, but I fear I cannot discuss them. Ah, but here's our tea. And now I have another surprise for you, Mr. Conway. Lotsen?
What a stunning girl.
You are pleased, Mr. Conway? It is well.
How very delightful. 18th century French, is it not?
You are quite correct. A gavotte by Rameau.
But who is the girl?
Her name is Lotsen. She has much skill with the Western keyboard music. Like myself, she has not yet attained the full initiation.
I should think not indeed. She looks hardly more than a child.
So you have women lamas here, then?
There are no sex distinctions among us.
Extraordinary business is lamahood.
Mm-hmm. Well, lady and gentlemen, I hope my little tour has proved enjoyable.
Yes, indeed. Most enjoyable.
Yes, indeed.
Then I am most happy to have been of some small service. Meanwhile, please consider the resources of this music pavilion and the library wholly at your disposal.
That is most generous. But what about the lamas? Don't they ever want to use them?
They yield place with much gladness to their honored guests.
Well, that's what I call real handsome. And what's more, it shows that the lamas do really know we exist. Makes me feel more at home somehow. You've certainly got a swell outfit here, Chang. And that little girl of yours plays the piano very nicely. How old would she be, I wonder?
I am afraid I cannot tell you.
You don't give away secrets about a lady's age, is that it?
Precisely. Ah, Mr. Conway.
What?
It is most calm and beautiful in the courtyards, is it not?
Indeed it is, Chang. And the moon makes it even more so.
Yes. Shangri-La is most beautiful in the moonlight. Touched with the mystery that lies at the core of all loveliness. But where are your companions?
I left them after dinner. I wanted to be alone. To think things out.
And I have interrupted your thoughts. I am sorry.
No, not at all.
Someone comes. Let us draw aside until they pass.
We obeyed the high ones of Shangri-La. He came through the air over the great mountains with a bird to hold him.
And he brought the strangers with him. Talor was not afraid of the outside wind or of the outside cold.
Though we went outside long ago, the valley of the blue moon still remembers him.
Over the great mountains with a bird to hold him. Talu must have been our pilot. Then he wasn't just mad. The whole thing was planned, carried out at the instigation of the High Ones of Shangri-La. But why, Chang?
Have no fear, Mr. Conway. You are quite safe at Shangri-La. And soon, I assure you, all these mysteries will be revealed to you. But in the meantime, if I were you, I would not share your discovery with your friends. It might only serve to distress them unnecessarily.
Well, I reckon some folks have to get used to far worse places. But you know, Chang, in some ways this is a damn bad hotel.
You are displeased?
Yeah. Don't you ever have any newspapers sent in? I'd give all the books in your library for this morning's Herald Tribune.
We have the files of the Times up to a few years ago, but only, I regret, Mr. Barnard, the London Times.
Yeah, I've noticed, Chang, that there's a temple in the valley. Is that a part of Shangri-La?
The temple has its own lamas who are under, shall we say, loose control from Shangri-La.
When I get back, I shall ask my society to send a missionary here.
They ought to send you. That is, of course, if you'd like a place like this.
It's hardly a question of liking it. It's a matter of what one feels one ought to do.
I think if I were a missionary, I'd choose this rather than quite a lot of other places.
In that case, there would be no merit in it, obviously.
But I wasn't thinking of merit.
More's the pity, then. There's no good in doing a thing because you like doing it. Look at the people here and in the valley.
They all seem very happy.
Exactly. Anyhow, I don't see why I shouldn't make a beginning by studying the language. Can you lend me a book about it, Mr. Chang?
Most certainly, madam. With the greatest pleasure. And if I may say so, I think the idea an excellent one. Perhaps you would care to come with me to the library.
Oh, yes, of course. This
way. I'll come too, if I may. Of course. I'd like to read a newspaper, even if it is only a back copy of the London Times.
What about you, Mallinson? Aren't you going with them? Are you going to the music pavilion to listen to the little Manchu girl playing? You seem to be taking quite an interest in music these days.
Yes, well, one has to do something. Besides, she plays very well.
She does indeed. Bach, Scarlatti, Mozart. Although, I can't make up my mind whether she plays for pleasure or if she's in some way a student.
Why don't you ask her?
She doesn't speak English. And I'm still rather reluctant to let them know I speak Chinese.
Yes, I see. I can't think what she's doing here. This Lama business may be all right for an old fellow like Chang, but what's the attraction in it for a pretty young girl? Do you suppose she likes being here?
Well, she doesn't appear to dislike it.
She doesn't appear to have any feelings at all, for that matter. She's more like a little ivory doll than a human being.
A charming thing to be like.
As far as it goes.
And it goes pretty far when you come to think about it. After all, the ivory doll has manners, good taste in dress, attractive looks, a pretty touch on the harpsichord, and she doesn't move about a room as if she were playing hockey. Western Europe, so far as I can recollect it, contains an exceptionally large number of females who lack these virtues.
You're an awful cynic about women, Conway.
Not at all. I'm 37 and you're 24. That's all it amounts to.
Talking of age, how old would you say Chang was?
Oh, anything between 49 and 149. I must say, Barnard has settled in well.
To tell you the truth, that fellow's cheerfulness is just about getting on my nerves.
Isn't it rather lucky for us that he does take things so well?
Personally, I think it's damned peculiar. What do you know about him, Conway? I mean, who he is and so on.
Well, not much more than you do. I understood he came from Persia and was supposed to have been oil prospecting. When the air evacuation was being arranged, I had quite a job to persuade him to join us at all.
Did you ever see his passport?
Probably, yeah, but I don't remember why.
Just this. Barnard was travelling on a forged passport, and he isn't Barnard at all.
I see. Well, who do you think he is, then?
He's Chalmers Bryant.
The deuce he is. What makes you think so?
He dropped his pocketbook this morning, and Chang picked it up and gave it to me, thinking it was mine. I couldn't help seeing it was stuffed with newspaper clippings. Well, some of them fell out. They were all about Bryant and the search for him and so forth. One of them had a photograph which was absolutely like Barnard, except for a moustache.
Did you mention a discovery to Barnard himself?
No, I just handed him his property without comment. Well, what are you going to do about it?
Probably nothing at all. What can one do in any case?
But dash it all, the man's nothing but a large-scale thief. I know plenty of people who've lost their money through him. Why, the fellow has been monkeying about on Wall Street to the tune of $100 million. There's a warrant for his arrest in America and extradition orders against him in half a dozen countries.
Well, if you'll take my tip, you'll say nothing about it. Not for his sake, but for ours. You please yourself, of course, so long as you don't forget the possibility that he may not be the fellow at all.
Well, I'll think about it.
Cigar, Mallinson?
No, thank you.
Sure you won't have one?
No. I said no, didn't I?
Well, I guess you all know who I am.
Yes, Mallinson and I think we do.
Damn careless of me to leave those clippings about.
Well, we're all apt to be careless at times.
I'm sure I don't know who you are, Mr. Barnard.
Gosh, but it's mighty queer. The whole damn business, I mean. Right across Europe, on through Turkey and Persia. They nearly got me in Vienna. It's pretty exciting at first, but it gets on your nerves after a bit. I got a good rest at Baskel, though. I thought I'd be safe in the middle of a revolution.
So you were, except for the bullets.
Yeah, that's what bothered me at the finish. Whether to stay in Baskel and get plugged, or accept a trip in your government's aeroplane and find the police waiting at the other end. I wasn't exactly keen to do either.
I remember you weren't.
Well, that's how it was. And you can figure out that the change of plan that brought me here didn't worry me an awful lot. This ain't a bad place when you get used to it. The air's a bit nippy at first, but you can't have everything. But I reckon it's just what the doctor ordered. I'm on a different diet. I can't look at the stock exchange ticker tape. And my broker can't get me on the telephone.
I dare say he wishes he could.
I think we'd better not argue about the past anymore. We're here now, that's the important thing. You know, it's curious, when you think about it, that of four people picked up, just by chance, and kidnapped 1,000 miles away, three of them should be able to find some consolation in the business. You, Barnard, want a rest cure and a hiding place. Miss Brinklow here feels a call to evangelize the heathen Tibetan.
Who's the third person you're counting? Not me, I hope.
I was including myself. And my own reason is perhaps the simplest of all. I just rather like being here.
Sir!
Old Chang!
I am proud to be the bearer of important news.
Well, what is it?
The High Lama has sent for you.
So I gather, but why all the fuss?
Because it is extraordinary and unprecedented. A fortnight ago you had not arrived, and now you are about to be received by him. Never before has it occurred so soon.
I'm still rather fogged, you know.
Oh, my dear sir, you will understand many things very soon. And may I add my own personal pleasure that this interval, always an awkward one, is now at an end. Believe me, it has been irksome to me to have to refuse you information on so many occasions. Extremely irksome. I am joyful in the knowledge that such unpleasantness will never again be necessary. Follow me, please. We have to ascend to the highest part of the Lamasery.
You are Mr. Conway?
I am.
It is a pleasure to see you, Mr. Conway. I sent for you because I thought we should do well to have a talk together.
Ah.
And, please, sit down and have no fear. I am an old man and can do no one any harm.
I feel it a signal honor to be received by you.
I thank you, my dear Conway. It is, as I said, a moment of great pleasure for me. My sight is poor, but believe me, I'm able to see you in my mind as well as with my eyes. I trust that you've been comfortable at Shangri-La since your arrival.
Extremely so.
I am glad. Chang has done his best for you, no doubt. He tells me that you've been asking many questions about our community and its affairs.
I am certainly interested in them.
Then, if you can spare me a little time, I should be pleased to give you a brief account of our foundation.
Oh, indeed.
Probably you're familiar with the general outline of Tibetan history. I am informed by Chang that you've made ample use of our library here.
Yes.
So, you will be aware that Nestorian Christianity was widespread throughout Asia during the Middle Ages, and that its memory lingered long after its actual decay. In the year 1719, four Capuchin friars set out from Pekin in search of any remnants of the Nestorian faith that might still be surviving in the hinterland. Three of them died on the way, but the fourth survived and eventually came to that rocky defile that remains to this day the only practical approach to the Valley of the Blue Moon. There was at that time an ancient lamasery existing on this same mountain shelf. Father Perrault, that was his name, conceived the idea of setting up a Christian monastery on the same site.
I see.
And so the buildings were repaired, and he himself came to live here in the year 1734, when he was 53 years of age. Well, in the course of time, the institution he had founded began to undergo a subtle change. It might be deplorable, but it was not really very astonishing, for it could hardly be expected that one man, unaided, should uproot permanently the habits and traditions of an epoch. He had no Western colleagues to hold firm to when his own grip relaxed. And it had perhaps been a mistake to build on a site that held much older and differing memories. His followers were devoted, even when they forgot his teaching, while the people in the valley held him in such reverent affection that he forgave them, with ever-increasing ease, their lapses into former customs. By the time he reached his 90th year, as you may suppose, many of his early disciples had died, and there were few replacements. Perrault's life at this time grew to be very calm and placid, waiting for the end. The valley people supplied food and clothing. His library gave him work, and he spent his days with his books, his memories, and the mild ecstasies of the narcotic obtained from the Tanksee berry, to which he had become somewhat addicted. But his mind remained so clear that he even embarked on a study of certain mystical practices that the Indians call yoga, and which are based upon various special methods of breathing.
I see.
Well, then, in the year 1789, news descended to the valley that Perrault was dying at last. Here, in this room, where he could see from the window the white blur that was all his failing eyesight gave him of Caracal, he was ready, willing, and glad to die. He bade farewell to his friends and servants, and then he asked to be left alone for a while. It was during such a solitude, with his body sinking and his mind lifted to beatitude, that he hoped to give up his soul. But it did not happen so. He lay for many weeks without speech or movement, but at last he began to recover. He was then 108 years old.
Good Lord!
Instead of convalescing idly, he plunged immediately into a rigorous self-discipline. Deep breathing exercises combined with narcotic indulgence could not have seemed a very death-defying regimen. Yet the fact remains that when the last of the old monks died in 1794, Perrault was still living. To the people of the valley, he soon became veiled in mystery, a hermit with uncanny powers. As the new century approached, the legend grew into a rich and fantastic folklore. It was said that Perrault had become a god, that he worked miracles, and that on certain nights he flew to the summit of Caracal to hold a candle to the sky. it was then, that a second stranger from Europe arrived in the Valley of the Blue Moon. A young Austrian named Henschel, who had soldiered against Napoleon in Italy. His first ambition was to enrich himself, for the valley is rich in gold deposits, and return to Europe as soon as possible. But he did not return. The valley, with its peacefulness and its utter freedom from worldly cares, tempted him again and again to delay his departure. And one day, having heard the local legend, he climbed to Shangri-La and had his first meeting with Perrault. I will not try to describe the association that sprang up between the two. The one gave utmost adoration, while the other shared his knowledge, his ecstasies, and the wild dream that had now become the only reality left for him in the world.
Please, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that is not quite clear to me.
I know. It would be remarkable if it were. It is a matter which I shall be pleased to explain before our talk is over, but for the present, if you will forgive me, I will confine myself to simpler things.
Certainly.
A fact that will interest you is that Henschel began our collection of Chinese art, as well as our library and musical acquisitions. It was Henschel's ingenuity which devised the complicated system by which the Lamasery has ever since been able to obtain anything needful from the outer world.
I suppose you found it easy to make payment in gold.
Oh, yes, we have been fortunate in possessing supplies of a metal which is held in such high esteem in other parts of the world.
Such high esteem that you must have been very lucky to escape a gold rush.
Yes, that was always Henschel's fear. He was careful that none of the porters bringing books and art treasures should ever approach too closely. He even arranged for sentries to keep constant watch. But soon it occurred to him that there was an easier and more final safeguard.
Yes?
You see, there was no need to fear invasion by an army. The most ever to be expected was the arrival of a few half-lost wanderers, who, even if they were armed, would probably be so weakened as to constitute no danger. It was decided, therefore, that henceforward strangers might come as freely as they chose. But with one important proviso. Over a period of years, such strangers did come. And not only were they now welcomed, if they chanced to find their way into the valley, but it became customary to meet them, if they ever ventured within a certain radius. All this was for a reason I will later discuss, but the point is of importance, showing that the Lamasery was no longer hospitably indifferent. Meanwhile, the Lamasery had begun to acquire many of its present characteristics. I must stress the fact that Henschel was exceedingly able and talented, and that the Shangri-La of today owes as much to him as to its founder. Yes, yes, quite as much, I often think, for his was the firm yet kindly hand that every institution needs at a certain stage of its development. And his loss would have been altogether irreparable had he not completed more than a life's work before he died.
He died?
Yes. It was very sudden. He was killed. It was in the year of your Indian mutiny. Just before his death, a Chinese artist sketched him. The portrait is there, Behind that curtain, if you would care to look.
Yes, thank you.
It is very well done, is it not? The delicacy of texture.
But this is the face of a young man.
Yes. Yes, the features are of great beauty.
But you said this was done just before his death?
Yes.
Then if he died in the year you said...
He did.
And he came here, you told me, in 1803, when he was a youth?
Yes.
Yes? He was killed, did you say?
Yes. An Englishman shot him. It was a few weeks after the Englishman had arrived at Shangri-La.
What was the cause of it?
Oh. There had been a quarrel about some porters. Henschel had just told him of the important proviso that governs our reception of guests. Perhaps you are wondering, my dear Conway, what that proviso may be.
I think I can already guess.
Can you, indeed? And can you guess anything else after this long and curious story of mine?
It seems impossible. And yet I can't help thinking of it. It's astonishing. It's extraordinary. And yet not absolutely beyond my powers of belief.
What is it, my son?
That you are still alive, Father Perrault.
In Part 2 of Lost Horizon by James Hilton, Derek Jacobi was Hugh Conway and Alan Wheatley was the High Lama. Mallinson, Andrew Branch, Barnard, Alan Tilven, Miss Brinklow, Carol Marsh, Chang, Gerard Green, and James Hilton, Alaric Cotter. The harpsichord was played by Anthony Mile. Lost Horizon is dramatized by Barry Campbell and directed by Graham Gold.
And the story concludes tomorrow at the same time as Conway realizes he may never leave the monastery.
TED Radio Hour on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. And on the show today, ideas about loneliness. If you've been feeling lonely during this time of social distancing, you're actually...
Word is to the kitchen gone, and word is to the hall. And word is up to Madam the Queen, and that's the worst of all, that Mary Hamilton's born a babe to the highest steward of all. Arise. thou hast done with thy wee babe, I saw and heard weep by thee. I put him in a tiny boat and cast him out to sea, that he might sink or he might swim, but he'd never come back to me. Arise, arise, Mary Hamilton, arise and come with me. There is a wedding in Glasgow town, this night we'll go and see. She put not on her robes of black, nor her robes of brown, but she put on her robes of white to ride into Glasgow town. As she rode into Glasgow town, the city for to see, the bailiff's wife and the provost's wife cried out, and alas for thee. Oh, you need not weep for me, she cried, you need not weep for me. For had I not slain my own wee babe, this death I would not leave. First she cradled me, the lands I was to travel in, and the death I was to deem. Last night I washed the Queen's feet and put the gold in her hair, and the only reward I find for this, the gallows to be my share. Cast off my gown, she cried, but let my petticoat be, and tie a napkin round my face, the gallows I would not see. Then by and come the king himself, looked up with a pitiful eye. Come down, Mary Hamilton, tonight you dine. My sovereign liege, and let your folly be. For if you'd a mind to save my life, you'd never have shamed me here. Last night there were four Marys, tonight there'll be but three. There was Mary Beaton, and Mary Seaton, and Mary Carmichael, and me.
shadow knows.
Blue Coal presents The Shadow, the mystery man who strikes terror in the very hearts of shopsters, lawbreakers, and criminals. Today, Coal Death. Ladies and gentlemen, an event of unusual interest will be broadcast from this studio at the end of the program. Be sure to listen. And before today's exciting adventure with The Shadow begins, I'd like to offer a suggestion for home heating comfort. The next time you need fuel, order Blue Coal, America's finest anthracite. You don't have to get a full supply. The Blue Coal dealer will be glad to send you a trial ton. Use it, compare it with your regular fuel in every way. It's 10-1 you will find Blue Coal gives you better heat at less cost. So order Blue Coal by name. Phone your order to your nearest Blue Coal dealer tomorrow.
Well, what do you want, Orson? Quiet job at Carverville, tender business. Fine mess you've made of things.
Oh, so you've seen the story in the paper about conditions up in the village?
Yes, you brainless fool. Don't you know you can't keep things quiet by manhandling a reporter?
Now, wait a minute, boss. I can explain that. We had to rough that reporter up. He was taking pictures.
I don't want any excuses. I pay you to manage my mill. If there's any more publicity about living conditions up there, you'll find yourself out of a job. Now get out. Don't bother me with details. Get out.
Okay, Mr. Carver, I won't bother you with details. But if anybody else comes up to Carverville snooping around and asking questions, we'll make them wish they never heard of the place.
Commissioner Weston, I tell you it's an outrage. Don't you agree, Cranston?
It's a pretty sorry state of affairs, Commissioner.
Granted, the conditions existing in this little mill village Daniel Carver owns are an outrage.
Why, he ought to be kicked out of this club.
What do you think, Cranston?
I agree, if the newspaper accounts are true. Sickness, half a dozen deaths recently.
The authorities ought to be able to do something about a man like Carver.
Apparently not. He owns Carverville, lux, stock, and barrel. Speak of the devil, here's Carver now.
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. I gather you're discussing me and the maliciously distorted story about Carverville that appeared in the papers.
As a matter of fact, we were, Mr. Carver. Yeah. Won't you sit down and give us your side of the story?
There's nothing to discuss. There isn't one word of truth in that reporter's story. The people in Carverville are perfectly satisfied. They don't complain.
Perhaps they don't dare.
They have no reason to complain, Cranston. I give them work in my mill, provide them with homes.
Homes? Why, they make the worst city slums look like Park Avenue.
Carverville is my affair.
Well, maybe so, but this club may have something to say about your membership, Daniel Carver.
This club, a bunch of mawkish busybodies. What do I care? Vote me out. No one ever speaks to me here anyway. Go ahead, vote me out. Vote me out, go ahead.
Must be some justice, some law.
Oh, he's within the law. But now here's a case for an amateur criminologist like yourself, Cranston.
Yes, there must be some way of helping those poor devils up in Carverville. Some way of dealing with a man like Carver.
Sir Mott Cranston, would you mind telling me the reason for this long drive in zero weather?
You'll soon see the reason, Margot. We're now entering Carverville. Take a good look at it.
Oh, how drab. How awful. Look, Lamont, broken windows stuffed with paper. I'm beginning to understand why you're here. But how did you hear about it?
Daniel Carver, the man who owns this charming little mill village, is a fellow club member of mine.
What are you going to do, Lamont?
I don't know exactly until I've talked to some of these people.
As Lamont Cranston or the Shadow?
As a nameless social worker for the present, Margot. But I have a strong hunch the Shadow will have to play a big part if anything is to be done to help these people. Here we are.
Want some gas, mister?
No, thanks. But could you tell me how to get to Mrs. Tucker's house?
What do you want? Ma Tucker's got enough trouble already, what with her old man and kid dying since the cold set in.
I read about it in the papers. We've come here to help.
Listen, mister. Carverville folks ain't got much. But we ain't asking or welcoming no nosing around from strangers.
If you'll just point out Mrs. Tucker's house, I'll see what she has to say.
Right over there by the creek. But don't say I didn't warn you, mister.
Thanks. Come along, Margot. I may need your help to get Mrs. Tucker's confidence.
Well, I'll do anything I can. You know, Lamont, there's something terrifying about this village.
Now, how so?
Oh, that man and the way people are watching us from behind curtains in the windows of every house along the street.
I'm afraid of something, Margot.
Of what?
That's just what I hope to discover in this house.
Oh, there's something sinister about this place.
Wait, Margot. Someone's coming to the door.
What do you want, mister?
Are you Mrs. Tucker?
I'm Ma Tucker. What do you want?
May we come in?
You say what you got to say.
Please, Mrs. Tucker, we've come to help you.
No, you... Oh, all right. Come in. It don't matter. Nothing matters now.
Thank you. Mrs. Tucker, we realize you've been through a terrible ordeal, losing your husband and son within a week.
Well, I ain't no worse off than anybody else in Carverville.
What are you going to do?
I got one boy left, Sam. He works in the mill.
Mrs. Tucker, how much rent do you people have to pay for these houses?
Hey, you better get out of here, mister. You don't want to get me in more trouble for talking to you at all. You better get out.
Who would make trouble for you because you talk to us?
Never you mind that, mister. And if you know what's good for you, you'll get out of Carverville before Dawson and the others from Carverville get here.
Hey, Ma, who are these folks?
This is my son, Sam.
Hello, Sam.
Well, howdy. You welfare workers from the city?
You might call us that. We've come here to investigate conditions.
They've been asking questions about the houses, Sam. I didn't tell them nothing.
Well, why didn't you, Ma?
Huh?
I'm sick of all this fear, old man Carver and his spies. We kept quiet for years, and what's it got us? What did it get Pa and young Jim? We slave in the mill, and they rob us at Carver's store, and we live in these pigsties that Carver calls houses, and when we're old and sick, he lets us die off like a lot of mangy dogs.
Shut up, Sam. Don't talk like that. Somebody'll hear.
Well, let him hear. Time somebody heard the truth. Can't you do something, mister? Can't you help us? If somebody don't help us, God only knows where this will end.
Thanks for speaking out, Sam. You'll have to help.
Lamont, there's a crowd gathering outside.
What?
I knew it. I knew there'd be
now,
trouble.
You be quiet, Ma. Listen, mister, I got a notion you're all right.
Ma Tucker! Sam! Open up! We're gonna chase them smart out here with strangers out of town, like we did that reporter.
Listen, Sam, we'll have to leave or there'll be trouble. Will you meet me in the next town in a couple of hours? I've got to know everything that's been going on here if I'm to help you.
Yeah, I'll meet you.
Look for my car on Main Street. Come on, Margot, keep close to me.
Lamont, I hope no one saw Sam Tucker meet us down this road as you asked him to.
I hope not, Margot.
What are you going to do now that he's told you the tragic story of Carverville?
Going back to Carverville.
Right now, tonight?
Yes, first to call on old man Carver.
I thought he was in the city.
He evidently heard that more strangers were in Carverville this afternoon asking questions.
Oh, what a beast Carver must be, Lamont. If he could only be made to see the misery and suffering he's caused.
He's going to see it, Margot, tonight.
Lamont, there's Carverville. Oh, not that I'm afraid,
we're stopping. That's Carver's house right ahead there.
Yes, I see a light downstairs, Lamont. What are you going to do?
Margot, do you remember Scrooge in Dickens' Christmas Carol?
Yes, and Carver is worse than Scrooge ever thought of being.
Tonight, Daniel Carver is going to feel more remorse than Ebenezer Scrooge ever did.
He deserves it. I'll wait in the car, Lamont.
It's bitter cold.
None of those poor people down there in those flimsy houses can stand it. I can. I'll wait here. But how are you going to make Carver visit those poor people?
Margot, tonight Daniel Carver is going on a sightseeing tour, personally conducted by the Shadow.
In just a moment, we will continue with the second part of the Shadow's thrilling adventure. While you are engaged in last-minute preparations for Christmas, don't neglect the health and comfort of your family. Be sure of a cozy, warm home during the holidays by ordering a supply of Blue Coal. No matter how cold or how mild the weather, Blue Coal is the most economical fuel for heating or cooking purposes. Up in the Arctic regions, where the temperature today is at least 60 degrees below zero, fur traders and trappers are keeping warm with Blue Coal. They've used other fuels, only to find that Blue Coal will keep them warm more economically than any other fuel. Blue coal is a Pennsylvania anthracite, the fuel that burns long and steadily. It is the fuel that furnaces, parlor stoves, and cooking ranges in New England were especially designed to burn. And the finest Pennsylvania anthracite is blue coal, mined by the Glen Alden Coal Company, employing American labor, and it is transported by American